nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Okay, so let's go ahead and get started. As I mentioned, we're going to spend two more days on scattering, then we'll move on to another topic. We won't have said everything that could be said about scattering, and we could spend a whole semester. But the idea is just to get enough of the concepts covered that you can learn whatever you need to learn when you encounter a research problem. And that's what you're going to be doing for the rest of your careers, right? Learning things on your own. That's what a PhD is all about. So we talked about scattering. We assumed bulk semiconductor. Most of the interest these days is in quantum confined structures. What has been for a long time, the channel of a MOSFET is carriers are quantum confined two-dimensional layer near the surface. So we haven't said anything about how scattering changes when you reduce the dimensionality. So that's what I want to cover today, is to talk about scattering in 3D, 2D, and 3D. We're just going to take one mechanism, accretion potential scattering, and we're going to see how it plays in different dimensions. And then we'll even, time at the end, we'll compute some mobilities and we'll see what the effect has to do with mobilities. There are some notes from some colleagues of mine that this lecture is based on, and if I get permission from them, we'll post the notes and there'll be more details on these calculations. So here's a question we're going to talk about today. Frequently, when you go to conferences or when you read papers, you see statements like this. The mobility should be higher in a nanowire, for example, because the density of states is reduced and the dimensionality. Scattering rates are proportional to the density of states, so you should have less scattering, so you should have higher mobilities. And the question is that true? Should you expect to have higher mobilities? And by the end of the lecture, we hope that we can give an answer to that question. All right, so here are all the things we want to get through. Let me, first of all, quickly review how we do this in 3D. This is what we've already talked about. And then we have to ask what changes in lower dimensions. So we have this prescription here. We have the transition rate, S of P to P prime. The prescription is to use Fermi's golden rule. We compute a matrix element. We sandwich a scattering potential between an initial and final state. And the initial and final states are plane waves. So we have electron waves propagating in three dimensions. And we've identified scattering potential, U sub S, for different types of scattering. And we can always write them as some coupling constant, which may depend on the wavelength of the lattice vibration, beta. And we did that for acoustic phonon scattering, optical phonon scattering, polar optical phonon scattering, and piezoelectric scattering. Okay. And the phonons themselves, U sub beta is the displacement of the lattice. A sub beta squared is the magnitude of the lattice vibration, which we had to be a little bit careful to get the quantum mechanically correct prescription for emission and absorption. N sub omega is the occupation number for bosons, for lattice vibrations, just like the Fermi factor for electrons. When we do acoustic deformation potential scattering, H bar omega is small compared to KT, and we can make this equipartition assumption. Can't do that for optical phonons. But in that case, N is approximately equal to N plus 1, and absorption and emission are just the same. Right. Now, there's one thing here that we're going to have to be careful about, which I haven't shown before. The scattering potential we've just written as K sub beta times U sub beta previously. And momentum conservation will pick out one particular beta that satisfies momentum conservation. Now, in reality, we have a Fourier series. We have vibrations of all different wavelengths, and we have to consider them all. We didn't worry about that because momentum conservation just picked out one. But there really is a sum over wavelengths there, and that's going to become important. Okay, so when we did this, we just inserted the scattering potential inside of the matrix element. We compute the magnitude squared of the matrix element, and we end up with a lattice displacement here in the initial and final wave vectors. The coupling constants, we just put together k sub beta, which was the electron-phonon coupling, a sub beta, which was the amplitude of the lattice vibration, and we end up with some coupling constants for acoustic phonons. So we've done that before. And when we do this matrix element, we just get something that's proportional to 1 over volume times these constants that have to do with the electron-phonon coupling and the magnitude of the lattice vibration, and then a delta function, which expresses momentum conservation. All right. So that we've all seen before, and then we take that scattering rate, or that transition rate between one P and another P, we sum over all the final states, and we can compute the scattering rate, the total probability per unit second that an electron will scatter somewhere. Acoustic deformation potential scattering was isotropic, so the momentum relaxation rate is identical. We can produce that sum, and we get a familiar result. The scattering rate is 2 pi over h bar times this quantity I'm calling u sub ac now, which has the electron-phonon coupling and the amplitude of the lattice vibration, and then it's proportional to half the density of final states. Okay. And we can put in numbers for all of those, and we get an equation for the scattering time. And the bottom line is that the scattering time is a bunch of constants times E divided by KT to the power minus 1/2. So this is in power law form, where the characteristic exponent is minus 1/2, and the constants we have expressions for. So we can calculate the mobility if we want to, put it in our normal expressions. All right, that's by way of review. That's the way we do it in 3D. And the question that we have now is, how do we do this in 2D? Looks like a pretty straightforward assumption. And I'm going to first of all do it in an approximate way called the momentum conservation approximation, which looks like a reasonable way to do it. And people sometimes use it, and it gets you sort of close to the right answer, but it's not quite right. In fact, so we have to do it, we have to go back to Fermi's golden rule and do it properly, and numerically we can get significantly different results. Okay, so we're going to have quantum confined carriers. We have some kind of potential well. Let's say that the electrons are confined in the z direction. Maybe this is normal to the surface. And the plane of a MOSFET, for example, would be in the xy plane. So the electrons are free to move in the xy plane, but they're confined in the z direction. In a MOSFET, the quantum well would have a little different shape. It would look more like a triangular barrier. But we won't worry about details like that right now. There's some kind of quantum well that confines the carriers in one dimension, but allows them to move freely in the other two. So these are two-dimensional electrons. So there are some energy levels, E1 and E2, which if we know the shape of the confining well, we can compute. To solve the Schrodinger equation. So the wave functions, when we do that computation, in the plane there's no confinement. So we're going to have plane waves in the xy plane. So there's going to be a plane wave like e to the I k parallel dot rho, where rho is a vector in the xy plane. And we'll divide by 1 over square root of area. So this is a normalization area in the 2D plane. Just like in the bulk, we have a normalization volume in 3D. So everything is free to move in the plane, so we have a plane wave there. But in the z direction, we have to solve the Schrodinger equation too. And we solve this by separation of variables, so there is some wave function in the z direction. It gives the z dependence of the wave function. If it's an infinite well, we can solve it analytically. In general, we have to solve it numerically. But if it's an infinite well particle in a box, we have a sine wave. We force the boundary conditions such that the wave function is zero at x at z equals zero and z equals w, and we get a sine kz times z, where kz is quantized in units of n pi over w. We normalize by square root of 2 over w, just so that psi star psi is equal to 1. All right. In general, we would have to compute that numerically, but we would get some function related to the quantum confinement in the z direction. Right. We could do it numerically if we needed to. We'll do it analytically here. Okay, so, and we've seen this all before, we have in the plane, if the electrons are in the first subband, then the bottom of the first subband is the bottom of that first quantum confined state, but then they can have kinetic energy when they move in the plane, so there's an h-bar squared, k parallel squared over 2m. Or they might reside in one of the upper levels, and they're the bottom of the conduction band for the up, for the second state is E sub 2, but then it has kinetic energy. So we have a set of bands like that, and electrons can reside in any one of those subbands. Energy versus K now looks like E versus K for the bulk, but instead of the bottom of the conduction band, I have an epsilon sub N, bottom of the subband that they're residing in. And instead of h-bar squared k squared over 2m, I have h-bar squared k parallel squared. It can only move in the parallel dimension. And if it's an infinite well, we can easily compute what those energies are. In general, we do it numerically. And then finally, the density of states. So we've seen this before also. Density of states in 2D is m over pi h-bar squared. So for the first subband, the states start at the bottom of the first subband, E sub 1, and then it's constant. For the second subband, there's another density of states that's just like that. If you want the total density of states, you just add them all together, and it's just given by this bottom expression here. Okay? All right, so let's see if we could try to treat scattering of these electrons. So they're like inversion layer electrons moving in the XY plane of a MOSFET. How would they scatter? So let's say I have an electron in this bottom subband, and it's moving from the source to the drain in the XY plane, and it scatters. Well, there are a couple of ways that it could scatter. It could scatter and stay within the first subband. So it could, say, absorb a lattice vibration and increase energy and momentum, or it could emit a lattice vibration and decrease energy and momentum. But it could stay in the first subband. Now remember, the momentum in the z direction is confined, is to discrete values because of the quantum confinement. Kz is n pi over w. So pz is h bar n pi over w. There are discrete values of momentum in the z direction. So in this type of scattering event, there would be no change in the momentum in the z direction. So if I were absorbing a phonon to do this, I would absorb a phonon that has no momentum in the z direction. Now, I could also envision scattering to the other subband. You could lose some energy, and the figure isn't quite right here. You lose some energy, and you still have to have enough energy to get into the upper subband. Now you've scattered to a different subband, so there is a change in the z-directed momentum. The second subband had a momentum that was pi over z times h-bar. So you had to change the momentum in the z-direction to get in the second subband. So you need to absorb a lattice vibration that has a z component of wave vector to give you that change in momentum. So we would picture this scattering event. If I look in the xy plane, the electron has some momentum in the xy plane, piece of parallel. It also has some momentum in the z direction, just given by the fact that it's in one of the subbands, and the momentum in those subbands is quantized in the z direction. Now the phonons. So phonons are a problem. You know, are the phonons quantum confined, or are they bulk? So frequently, the way we do these structures is you either produce a quantum well, like in a MOSFET, with a potential energy barrier, or you grow semiconductor films with different band gaps, and the materials have roughly the same lattice constants. So the phonons are not, many times the phonons are not strongly affected. They're still more or less what they were like to begin with. But they still can have a wave vector in the XY plane or in the Z plane. So I'll think of these phonons as bulk phonons, but they have wave vectors in the x and y directions. That's beta parallel. And they have wave vectors in the z direction. That's beta z. So when I undergo one of these scattering events, I'll have an electron that comes in with some momentum in the xy plane. It scatters to some other momentum in the xy plane. And there's an h-bar beta parallel that allows me to satisfy momentum conservation in the xy plane. And then if this scattering event also moved me from one subband to another, then there's a z component of that lattice vibration that helps me satisfy momentum conservation in the z direction. Okay, so that's the picture that sort of looks plausible. Let me pause and see if there are any questions on this, because I'm going to explain in a minute that this isn't quite right.
Since phonons are not confined, so if there is an intra-subband scattering, how can we have this beta z with dz zero?
Well, the phonons will have a whole distribution of momentum, right, in different directions. Some of them will have beta. Some of them will not have a beta in the z direction, right? They have components in the x, y, and z direction. So in order to do this intra-subband scattering, we just pick out those phonons that happen not to be propagating in the z direction. And those are the ones that are going to be involved.
Is this the reason why scattering is less?
Well, we haven't yet determined whether scattering really is less. That's the question we asked. We haven't answered that question yet. So let's see. Let's continue. All right, what's wrong with that? Well, what's wrong with that is that we have this uncertainty principle. You know, delta P, delta Z is greater than or equal to H bar. If we haven't confined anything in space, then we can have momentum conservation. Then we can locate the momentum precisely. Right? So for electrons that are not confined in space, the momentum is well defined. But these electrons are confined. Right? They're confined in a small quantum well of width W. If we confine them spatially, there's going to be some uncertainty in the momentum. So we can't talk about this precise momentum conservation. There's no need to conserve momentum in the z direction, right? Because there's an uncertainty in the z value. We can have a whole spread. Now that would lead you to think that maybe the scattering is higher, because you don't have to conserve momentum conservation in the normal direction. So the momentum does not need to be conserved when we quantum confine it. Now recall, this is not so surprising. When we talked about energy conservation, I didn't go through the derivation of Fermi's golden rule, but it's done in the textbook. And you'll notice that energy conservation only occurred for long times. You know, we had to assume that there was a long time between scattering events in order to get this delta function that conserves energy. Under short times, energy is not strictly conserved. So it's the same kind of thing. We have an uncertainty relation, delta E, delta T is greater than or equal to H bar. So energy is conserved only for long times. We have one delta P, delta Z is greater than H bar. So momentum is conserved only when things are not spatially confined. Same kind of thing. So while this is it's a good way to think about what's happening to zeroth order, it's not a good way to get numbers. We have to go back to Fermi's golden rule, and we have to see if we can derive the scattering rate more carefully. See what happens then. All right, that's what the rest of the lecture is about, basically. How do we do this properly without assuming momentum conservation? Okay. So let's see. The first question is, what changes? We're going to go back to Fermi's golden rule. Right? That's not going to change. We're still going to use the same prescription. We're going to sandwich a scattering potential. We're going to use the same acoustic phonon deformation potential scattering. So those constants are all the same. I'm going to assume bulk phonons. So this is not easy to justify. Sometimes it gives us answers that are reasonable, but there are many times where the phonons themselves are also confined, and there are whole textbooks on this problem, and I'll refer you to some at the end. That can lower the scattering rates, just because there's only a few betas that are available. You might not have the right beta to conserve momentum. People talk about phonon bottlenecks, for example, in things like quantum dots. You haven't got a phonon that will allow you to make a transition between two electronic states. But we're going to assume bulk phonons. So sometimes if you work, it's easier to confine electrons than it is to confine phonons. Because especially if you have a semiconductor stack, heterostructure stack, the lattice constants, the elastic materials are not that different. So the phonons might not be strongly changed from their bulk values. So I'm going to assume that I have a phonon propagating in three dimensions, just like we did before. Yes?
I wanted to ask you whether in the summation over beta, any Unglaub transition is
We're our Umklapp process. You know, we may talk. No, Umklapp processes, I think, are being ignored in this, and we might talk about that on Wednesday. What are Umklapp processes, and when do they become important? But we're not going to worry about Umklapp processes today. Okay. So when we did 3D. We had an initial state that was a 3D wave function. We had a final state that was a 3D wave function. And we had a phonon that was a 3D lattice vibration. And that led to our delta function. Okay. So now we're going to repeat this calculation. We're going to keep the 3D phonons, because otherwise I have to go and I have to solve elastic propagation problems for specific structures, and I can get all kinds of interesting effects that occur, but they're going to be very problem specific. But we are going to assume that we have 2D electrons, like in a quantum well. So the 2D electrons, just like we talked about earlier for the momentum conservation approximation, they're plane waves in the XY plane, parallel direction. But they have some kind of Z dependence that depends on the shape of the quantum well. We just find that by solving Schrodinger's equation. The phonons are the same phonons we've been using. They're 3D. They're not affected by any confinement. But they have a direction that's parallel to the XY plane, and they have a direction that's perpendicular to the XY plane. So we just separate those two out, treat them separately. So we're going to then simply put these wave functions into the matrix element and work it out and see what we get. All right, so here's our matrix element. We put the initial electron wave function, which is here on the end at the right, fn of z times a plane wave in the xy plane. Our final wave function, which is over here on the left, fn prime. Fn means it's in subband n. Fm prime means it might have scattered to subband n prime. It might be a different subband. But it also has depending on what subband it is, it'll have a different envelope function in the z direction, and it has a plane wave propagating in the xy plane. And then we sandwich in between that this phonon, and we just separate out the phonon wave vector into its parallel and z-directed parts. All we've done is to substitute those wave functions in there. All right, now let's do a little bit of, and then we have the sum over all of these. This is the sum over beta that I didn't worry too much about earlier, but we're going to carry it through now. So we have the sum over all of the wave vectors, beta, that could give rise to electron phonon scattering. Okay, so let's rearrange things here. Let's take the K parallels and the K parallel primes and the beta parallel, and let's collect them all up together. So that's the first integral, 1 over area, e to the minus I, K parallel prime minus K parallel minus or plus beta parallel dot rho. So this is the components that are propagating in the XY plane. And then let me take the Z component of the phonon and let me put it with the Z component of the electron wave functions and do the integration over Z separately, right? And then I have my sum over all the phonon wave vectors out front here. Okay, so if I look at this integral, the one involving the wave vectors in the parallel plane, this is very much like the one we had in the bulk. And it's going to lead to a delta function, just like it did in the bulk. But it's only going to lead to a delta function in the plane. So momentum conservation will work in the XY plane. The P parallel prime will be the incident P parallel plus or minus H bar beta parallel. Right? But then I have this business involving the shape of the wave function in the Z directions and the component of the phonon wave vector in the Z directions. This is the part we were ignoring when I did this momentum conservation assumption. So we have to evaluate that integral. So that integral is called a form factor. And when we look at that integral, we're going to have to evaluate that integral because the matrix element that we're computing is going to look very much like the 3D one. We have a 1 over area instead of a 1 over volume. You know, we took one of the dimensions and we put it in this second integral. We have some constants that involve the electron-phonon coupling and the phonon amplitude. We have a delta function now which just conserves momentum in the XY plane. And then we have something extra. We have the form factor. And we have to compute that form factor. So what's happened in going from 3D to 2D is relatively simple. We've just added this form factor that we have to worry about. Okay, so how do we evaluate that form factor? Okay. Well, I've got this I have this sum over betas, and I can convert the sum over betas to an integral over betas with my usual prescription. It'll be there'll be a normalization distance here, so it'll be a L over 2 pi times an integral over d beta z times this integral that I'm trying to do. So we just convert the sum over beta to an integral over beta. And now we have to do some work, you know, and I'll just sort of quickly show you what the, how this all works out. These wave functions, these are real. These are things like sine kx, right? So I can separate out this magnitude squared, and I can just take the integral of fn prime star fn over dz, and I can take the integral of fn prime fn. I can do it twice, and I'll get magnitude. Boom, boom. I'll get magnitude squared. Okay, so I'm doing this integral twice, so I'm multiplying it, basically doing the integral, multiplying it by itself twice. Now, we can do a little rearrangement here. Since I'm doing this integral over z, I'm integrating out z. So I could just as well give z another name. So let me call it z prime. Because I'm going to integrate it out. It doesn't matter what I call the variable. So once I've done that integral, I've done that change of variables, I have an integral that looks like this. Okay. Now when I look at this, I can use, I'm just going to invoke a theorem with a little bit of work. You may have seen this if you've taken a quantum mechanics course before. This integral I have out front, you can kind of see that you're not going to get a contribution unless z is equal to z prime. So it's actually, you can show that with this normalization constant here, it's actually a delta function of z minus z prime. Meaning now that I'm only going to get a result when z prime is equal to z. So my form factor squared is going to be the product of an fn magnitude squared of the initial wave function, multiplied by the magnitude squared of the final wave function in the z direction. All right. So this is how we evaluate this form factors. Now, in general, we know these because we've solved the Schrodinger equation. So, you know, people who do careful calculations solve this numerically. You know what the wave function is in the z direction, and now you can calculate these form factors. If I have an infinite well, then I know that they're sine functions, and then I can do these integrals analytically. And if you do these integrals, you will find that if n is equal to n prime, you get 3/2 over w for this integral. And if n is not equal to n prime, you just get 1 over w. So for an infinite quantum well, these form factors can be evaluated analytically, and we get these simple results. All right. So you can kind of see now what's happened here is that if I look at intra-subband scattering, when I did the momentum conservation approximation, I didn't have this form factor. When I do it carefully, I introduce this form factor. And that form factor squared is equal to 3/2. So I have 50% more, I'm going to have 50% more scattering because of that. I don't have to satisfy momentum conservation. So the relaxation of momentum conservation is going to give me additional scattering. So the recap is like this. My matrix element from 3D goes to something that looks very similar, but I've introduced this thing called the form factor. The form factor we can evaluate. If we have an infinite barrier, we can evaluate it analytically. And the constants here are the same as the constants were in 3D. So we've just picked up this form factor. So now we expect increased scattering. So if I compute the 2D scattering rate, I'm just going to compute this sum now. And if you do that sum, it's going to work out very much like it did before. We're going to get all the same constants, 2 pi over h bar. We're going to get a bunch of constants relating to the electron-phonon coupling and the magnitude of the phonon. We're going to get half the density of final states. It's a 2D final states now instead of a 3D final states. And we're going to get this form factor squared, which we can do analytically. Okay. So we can put all the constants in, and we can evaluate the scattering time. Density of states is independent of energy, so the scattering time is going to be independent of energy. And we can write the scattering times in power law form. It's going to go as e divided by kt to the power 0. And we can collect up all of the constants, and we have those also. So if we compute the scattering rate versus energy, you know, for the first one, our form factor gives us a 3/2. So if I write that scattering rate as the first set of constants, gamma 0 times the form factor, tau sub 1 to 1, intra-subband scattering in subband 1, just gives me a step function with a magnitude 3/2, gamma 0. If I get up to high enough energy that an electron in subband 1 can scatter into subband 2, then the form factor is just gives me a 1 here. So I get a little bit more scattering, and then I get a little bit more scattering. So we can compute the scattering rate versus energy in this kind of picture like this. All right. Sort of what we would have guessed, it just goes proportional to the final density of states. But we have a little bit more. Because of this form factor, we have a little bit bigger for the first step than we do for the others. Okay. All right, we can do that for 1D also, but I'm not going to go through this whole calculation for 1D. In 1D, let's say that we have electrons that are confined in two directions. So we have a nanowire now. Okay. Now, here's where you would really start to worry about confined phonons. Now, you can grow freestanding nanowires. Okay. There's no reason to believe that the lattice vibrations in that nanowire look anything like the ones in the bulk material. Right? So assuming the 3D phonons is really very problematic in this case. So you can see lots of papers these days about calculating phonon dispersion curves in nanowires. You really should use the not quantum confined, but the structurally defined phonons for these calculations. But to get an idea of what goes on, we can use the same assumption. We could envision somehow growing a nanowire that we've grown a heterostructure and we've embedded it in a semiconductor structure where all the lattice constants are close to the same. So we could assume 3D phonons, 1D electrons. We'll get momentum conservation only in the x direction because that's the only unconfined direction. And we will have a form factor that involves the quantum confinement in two dimensions. So those form factors, we'll have to solve a Schrodinger-Poisson equation in 2D to find out what the wave functions look like if they're confined in both the x or both the y and the z directions. And we'll have a plane wave in the x direction. If I have an infinite barrier, and if I have a wire that's w times w square, then I'm going to have a sine function in each direction, so we know what those wave functions look like in the y and the z direction. We could compute this form factor squared again, and we're going to end up getting something very similar to what we had before. We just have to square it. Okay. All right. So then if we compute the scattering rate, we'll just have to sum over all of the final states. We only have final states in one direction, and we will get something that looks very similar, 2 pi over h bar times u sub ac times the density of states, half the density of states, but only the 1D density of states now. You know, and 1D density of states is generally less than the 3D density of states. This is why oftentimes you'll hear people say they expect the scattering rate to be less in 1D. But we have this form factor, and that's bigger than 1. So the relaxation of the momentum conservation leads to a factor that's bigger than 1. So I can collect up all the constants. The scattering time is going to go as e to the power 1/2. So it's in power law form with the characteristic exponent of plus 1/2, and we can collect up all the constants. And I'll probably have a homework assignment sometime to ask you to check to be sure I've done all my algebra properly, that all those constants are right. But the main points there are right. So the scattering rate versus energy, if we look at the scattering from subband 1 to subband 1, it'll just follow the density of states, and it'll have a form factor that's 3/2 squared in 1D now. And then if I look for scattering from subband 1 to subband 2, it'll have a form factor that's 1, and it'll start when the electron in subband 1 has enough energy now that it can scatter into subband 2. And if it has enough energy that it can scatter into subband 3, then there'll be another possible scattering rate from subband 1 to subband 3. And the total scattering rate for an electron entering in subband 1, we would just add all of those together. And it would mimic the density, the 1D density of states, but it would be a little bit different because of these form factors that are different for different transitions. Okay. So the main goal is for you to sort of see how people address this problem. And the final question that I want to get to is, what are the implications for mobility? So we understand now how to think about scattering in different dimensions. It's always going to look like a transition rate. It's always going to look very similar. The constants u sub ac are going to be similar. There's a dimension L. This should be L to some power d. So it's L in 1D, it's area in 2D, it's volume in 3D. So there's a typo there. There is a delta function that expresses momentum conservation in the unconfined directions. There are either three of them, two of them, or one of them. There is a form factor, which is 1 for 3D, but which is different for 2D and different for 1D. And there is a delta function that expresses energy conservation and momentum. All right. So we can sum that up and we get a scattering rate that versus energy that just depends on the density of final states in the particular dimension and also on the form factor, which depends on the particular dimension. Little d is a dimension, 1, 2, or 3. Now, if we want to compute the mobilities, we remember that mobility is Q average tau over M. In all three cases, the characteristic time had power law form. It just had a different characteristic exponent S. And then when I do this average, it depends on whether I'm doing the average value of E tau divided by the average value of E in 1, 2, or 3 dimensions. So we worked that out in a lecture long ago. I think it was gamma of S plus 5 halves over gamma of 5 halves in 3D. I think you worked it out in exam 2 for 2D. If you work it out for any dimension where little d is 1, 2, or 3, you'll get this expression. Okay. So we've figured out what all of these numbers are. All we have to do is to plug them in and we can calculate the scattering rate in 1D or 2D or 3D. So, you know, we know what the exponents are in 1D, 2D, 3D. We know what the prefactor is in 1D, 2D, and 3D. So one of the things that it's interesting to observe from this is that the mobility or scattering time is going to depend on the effective mass in different ways in different dimensions. In 1D, it's a square root of effective mass. In 2D, it's 1 over effective mass. In 3D, it's 1 over effective mass to the 3 halves power. So when you're looking at semiconductors with different effective masses and you want to know what mobilities will they get, it'll depend on whether you're making the structure in 1D, 2D, or 3D. If you look at the temperature dependence, it also varies with dimension. A lot of times experimentalists will look at the temperature dependence and they will try to deduce what scattering mechanism is operating here. If you were in 3D, the temperature dependence will be as KT to the minus 3 halves power for acoustic deformation potential scattering. If you're in 2D, it'll be as 1 over KT. If it's you're in 1D, it'll be as 1 over KT to the 1 half. So if you're doing experiments on the temperature dependence and you're trying to deduce what scattering mechanism is going on there, you'll have to be careful about what dimension you're working in. All right, plug numbers in. And again, I'm going to ask you to check the algebra. The results aren't pretty, but the process is relatively straightforward. So we get these answers for the mobilities in 1D, 2D, and 3D. And here, I'm hoping to be able to post these notes. It's not obvious in looking at these which one is higher. But there are some arguments you can go through under some typical conditions to decide if you're restricted to one subband, what do the mobilities look like? And to be restricted to one subband, KT has to be less than the subband spacing. So there are some arguments you can go through to look at what happens under typical conditions. And if I'm able to post these notes, you'll be able to see this in more detail, but it takes a few minutes to go through. But the bottom line is that the mobility is a little bit less in 2D than it is in 3D. It's not bigger. And if I compare the I think I may have a typo here. If you look at the mobility in 1D compared to 3D, the mobility is this factor 2 times the square root of pi over 3 is 1.2 or something. So this ratio, I have to double check this. This ratio should be mu 1D over mu 3D. So in 1D, it's a little bit higher, but just a little bit. So the bottom line is we don't expect a whole lot of change in mobility with dimensionality. The density of states change dramatically. The mobility doesn't change by very much. Why does that happen? Because we reduce the density of states, but we increase the form factor. And when you put the two of those together, you don't get any striking difference. So you shouldn't expect a big difference in mobility for this toy problem. Again, let me reinforce this statement about mobility. Very frequently, experimentalists will grow a semiconductor film, measure the mobility or Hall effect mobility versus temperature. We talked about earlier how if you see a mobility increasing as T to the 3 halves power, you say, aha, that means there's ionized impurity scattering going on in this sample. If you go to higher temperatures and the mobility drops as T to the minus 3 halves, you say, aha, it's acoustic phonon scattering. But if you're working in 2D, you'd look for a T to the minus 1 power. If you're working in 1D, you'd look for the T to the minus 1 half power. All right. Now, there's a lot more to this story. There are books on this subject, and there are people still doing lots of research on it. If you really want to see carefully how you do these calculations, and especially how you treat confined phonons, in many problems, it's not good enough quantitatively to assume bulk phonons. In some cases, in a freestanding nanowire, it doesn't even make any sense to assume bulk phonons. And there are two excellent books where they discuss these in detail. The first one is mostly on layered structures that you might grow by epitaxy. And the second one is more general. It does wires and other structures too. So if you need to see how that all works out, that's the way to do it. Okay. Now, there are lots of things. If you really want to know what happens, say, in a nanowire, we have just done a toy problem here. We have said, what if only acoustic deformation potential scattering operates and the phonons are 3D? In reality, it's unlikely that any one of those two are going to happen. There'll be other scattering mechanisms and the phonons won't be 3D. So it really takes a lot more work to solve this problem properly. One of the big things that can happen is that the nanowire can be very sensitive to surface roughness. You're confined in a very small dimension. There may be roughness on the wire. So let's think of here's an example of some calculations that a student of mine did a few years ago. Let's think that you have a small nanowire and 3 nanometers by 3 nanometers. So look at the cross section. And this was just a calculation to show what might happen. The red area here is the silicon. It's discretized into finite elements, the little triangular layers here. The oxide around it is the blue region. And then he just went around and, by random numbers, randomly converted one of those surface triangles to an oxide or left it as a silicon. So the result is that you get a rough interface. So what happens? Well, these are energy band diagrams from the source along the gate and out the drain of this little nanowire transistor. When you're off, there's a big energy barrier there. The energy in the drain is low because you've applied a drain bias. Energy is minus Q times drain bias. When you turn it on, you apply a gate voltage and push the barrier down. But look at how rough that conduction band is. There's this random fluctuation in the width of the nanowire. Sometimes it's a little bit narrower on average. Sometimes it's a little bit wider on average. He numerically solved the Schrodinger equation to get those confined wave functions, the Fn of z, the Fn of y and z in this direction. And what you can see is a fluctuation. You can see a rough conduction band. So the electron waves that propagate along, they see that random fluctuation, and they're going to reflect off of it. That's surface roughness scattering. And that's one of the most difficult things to do to maintain when you're doing nanowires is how do you maintain a smooth interface so that this doesn't degrade the mobility. All right, so let's return to that question. You know, should we expect the mobility to be higher? Well, in general, there are so many things at play, and the scattering mechanisms are so different in the 1D structure than they are in the bulk, that there's no general answer to that question. You have to look at how smooth you can make the interface, what the phonon modes are going to be like. But we tried to look at some general considerations just with this simple little toy problem, and we found that there are two things at play. There's a density of states which the quantum confinement tends to lower. So that tends to make the mobility higher. But there's a relaxation of momentum conservation, which means more phonons can contribute to scattering, which tends to increase the scattering rate. And when you put the numbers in, what you find is that even in this toy problem where we've ignored complications like phonon scattering, surface roughness scattering, you don't expect a big problem. Now, what's the answer in general? If you had quantum confined, or if you had confined phonon modes, you might find yourself in a situation where you just don't have many phonons with the right wave vector to permit you to scatter from one state to another state. So you could conceivably increase the mobility there. And people are still doing calculations to try to answer those questions. Okay. I covered a lot of ground. I will try to define an appropriate homework problem so that you can go through it more carefully. And hopefully, you know, what you've taken away from this lecture, I hope, is just a general appreciation about how you think about scattering in reduced dimensions. So one more lecture about scattering, and then we'll move on to a new topic.